Welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, June 5th, 2022. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a playwright, journalist, and historian with a number of books. His new book, The Book of Broadway Musical Debates, Disputes, and Disagreements, will be released in September of 2022 and can now be pre-ordered on Amazon. Peter also has columns at Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, Encore Monthly, and many other places. Hello, Peter.
Hi.
So, I was going to ask you for your best joke that you're going to use at the Theater World Awards tomorrow, but no, we'll save it for the Theater World Awards tomorrow at Circle in the Square.
Yeah.
So, you're all prepared for it?
I think so. We shall see what we shall see. But, yeah, we're pretty excited. Javi Firestein will be there. So will Matthew Broderick, Brandon Durndon, Andrea McArdle. So a lot of nice people will be there to either present or accept, and we shall see what we shall see. But I'm certainly looking forward to it.
Oh, it's a great tradition. I'm so glad it's back.
I will say this. My jokes will involve Hello, Dolly, Follies, Mac and Mabel, Chorus Line, and a few other surprises too. So, those are relevant to what I'll be talking about tomorrow.
I noticed the words "funny" and "girl" are not there.
I did too.
or music and man.
I will tell you that there was such a great temptation to make a joke about funny girl. And I have a feeling when I start the line, people are going to say, oh my God, he's going to mean, no, I'm not. So I'm leaving it alone. Don't forget, Harvey's going to be there. Remember?
Yeah, well, yes.
Oh,
yeah, yes,
that's
yes.
True. That's true.
So we don't want him walking out. So
no, absolutely.
And by the way, it just occurred to me something, you know, we had discussed the pluses and minuses of Funny Girl at length. Mm-hmm. There was something that I'm ashamed to say I didn't notice that a friend of mine pointed out to me, and he was very upset. But Harvey took it upon himself to change the place where Fanny Bryce came from, just because Harvey is from Brooklyn and he always puts Brooklyn into everything that he does. Hmm. I mean, was that really necessary? Uh-huh. He came from the Lower East Side, and there's, I think there is a Henry Street in Brooklyn, but that's
there
not
is,
the,
in fact, yeah. Mm.
But that's not the one they mean. Maybe he was confused.
Uh-huh. How funny. Well,
Brooklyn is really the Lower East Side. Lower.
It's the east side. The Lower East Side.
Yeah, I can see Russia from there.
Yeah.
So that other voice, of course, is Michael Portantier. Michael's a theater reviewer and essayist. He's the founder and editor of castalbumreviews.com. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
And we're so multifaceted and busy here. Peter's got the Theater World Awards, and Michael, in a couple of weeks, you have the Boys from Syracuse concert featuring John and Matthew Drinkwater, J. Avery Jones, and more coming up at June 16th at 54 Below. And we'll be talking, hopefully, to the Drinkwaters next week.
That'd be great.
Yeah. So anything exciting to point out about the Boys from Syracuse? You locking it up? Everybody off book?
Yeah, I'm still trying to get, to be honest, we haven't locked in someone for that little cameo role of the Seeress at the end. But I might have something fun to report on that soon.
Well, if only you could get Lin-Manuel Miranda to do it, but he's, you know, he's in, he's entertaining the Queen at the Jubilee.
Yes.
You know? He is very, very busy. So something I wanted to remind and maybe let everybody know about is that Jan Simpson's newest episode of All the Drama had just been released on Patreon yesterday. It's The Young Man from Atlanta, and Jan talks with special guest Ben Brantley about The Young Man from Atlanta. Oh. So Ben Brantley's, I think, debut on Broadway Radio. Here. So check it out. It'll be in our public feed next Saturday, but it's available on Patreon now for those who support us at broadwayradio.com/Patreon or patreon.com/Broadway Radio. One of those two. And next week, we're going to make our Tony Award predictions on the morning of the Tony Awards, which is June 12th. And so Peter, Michael, and I will be going through the categories and letting you know what we think about various things. And Peter, the Drama Desk, Peter and Michael, both Drama Desk Award voters. The cutoff for voting is tomorrow at midnight. Have you got your ballots in?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good. Excellent. So something I wanted to mention at the top of the show, we don't very often cover news and things like this, but something on the front page of the New York Times about a new casino possibly opening up in Times Square. There's three casinos that are being proposed for Manhattan. One is across the street. It's across the street from St. Patrick's Cathedral. So the sinners and the saints, Guys and Dolls? Yes. Yeah. Can they do a Guys and Dolls there and do, honorary David Merg production where they can walk across the street, you know? So one of them's planned to be atop the Saks Fifth Avenue at St. Patrick, across the street from St. Patrick's. And then another one is,
you said the Hard Rock Cafe, where the Hard Rock Cafe is.
They're saying there's going to be a Hard Rock Casino in the center of Times Square. And I can't really figure it out because right now Hard Rock is at 1501 Broadway. And I can't imagine that they could make a casino there. I wonder what's going to happen.
I always wondered what the basement is like there, because that, of course, was where the Paramount Theater was. Mm-hmm. And I assumed the theater was on street level. But, you know, if it was a theater, then it might go down a ways. Although, would they want a casino? Well, I guess it would be fine to have a casino in a basement, right? Because they don't have windows.
No windows, yeah. No windows. I think that I've done downstairs at the Hard Rock.
Okay.
I wonder, I think that there's only one or two levels down there. So I don't really know. We have to wonder what's happening with over at the Palace Theater, where they've just lifted it two stories, and it hasn't reopened yet for the hotel that's going to be there. I mean, are they thinking about something there? I don't know.
That's a very good point. Yeah, that could happen.
But
yeah.
my main concern here is that I think that a casino in Times Square or anywhere in the theater district is bad for Broadway. And it's bad for Broadway because it's going to raise rents, and it's, people are going to be like,
if
I can put... Yeah, well, no, I mean, absolutely. If a casino owners want to get into... Casinos want to be near other casinos. Mm. So if they could put another casino somewhere else in Times Square, or a third casino in Times Square, it's going to raise rents, and people have to decide, landlords have to decide, do I want to keep a theater there, or do I want to open up a casino there and make more money? And so I think that the Broadway League's really got to engage in this issue, and I haven't seen anything yet.
Well, I do feel that so many people will lose so much money that they won't be able to go to Broadway. So I think it will impact ticket sales that way. And I'm serious about that, because there's only so much disposable income, and it's very easy to dispose of income at a casino.
Mm, That's true.
And another item of concern, speaking of the Paramount, as I mentioned before we started recording it, that there's a great concern that the what is currently called the Paramount Hotel on, is that 46th? Is that right?
Yeah, it's something around there. I was just looking it up. Yeah.
It may become a homeless shelter. Mm. Right in the middle, that huge thing right in the middle of Times Square. So this has been discussed a lot lately, and with the mayor involved and everyone else. And I think that there are going to be petitions and things of that sort. So you might want to pay attention to that if you share the concern that so many people have about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I have a few articles from the New York Times about the Paramount Hotel, and CBS News talks about it was a former Radisson Hotel that looks like it they're trying to make into a homeless shelter. So these are all, you know, sort of outside of the purview of Broadway, but they will definitely affect and impact Broadway and the ability to see good theater in the theatrical district. Good or bad, we don't know, but it's kind of crazy. Michael, also, you brought up that there was a new ticket transparency bill happening.
Yeah, some good news. I'll just read this little brief article in Vulture. It's called New York Passes Bill to Make Ticket Prices More Transparent. And it says you might still get ripped off, but at least you'll know by how much. On Friday, June 3rd, New York's Assembly passed legislation that would increase transparency in the ticket buying process for live events like concerts and plays. Under Senate Bill S-946, sellers like Ticketmaster and StubHub will no longer be able to hide fees until the last step in checkout. Instead, all such costs must be disclosed upfront so that prices don't change throughout a purchase. Delivery fees will be banned on tickets that are sent electronically or that a buyer has to print themselves. I mean, I've always thought that was ridiculous. They charge you to print it yourself?
Yeah, really.
I actually know why that is, though.
Oh, really? Tell us.
Yeah, I know why that. Because it's an outside company that does it for the ticket seller. So the outside company takes care of all the technology and things like that around the ticket printing. And the ticket seller, whoever it might be, whether it be StubHub or, you know, Telecharger, Ticketmaster, something like that, pays this outside company a couple of dollars for each thing.
I see.
But,
I got
but that's why outside printing is additional cost. But I think that since they're going to have to not charge it, they're going to have to roll it into every ticket, whether or not it's printed at home.
Right. So they'll just go, they'll just raise the actual price.
Yeah, exactly.
And one more important thing on this bill is online seller online reseller marketplaces will be required to share a ticket's original price. And also tickets that were initially free can no longer be sold at any price through resellers. So those are all pretty major changes if they can, if this, and now apparently this has been passed, the bill has been passed, and all it awaits now is the signature of the governor, Kathy Hochul.
Did you guys hear about NYU's graduation at Yankee Stadium a couple of weeks ago?
No, no. What happened?
So NYU, I shouldn't say always, but for a number of years has had their graduations at Yankee Stadium. And all of a sudden, the tickets started to be resold and scalped for thousands of dollars.
My God.
Thousands and thousands of dollars. And I was like, what's going on here? It's because Taylor Swift was getting an honorary doctorate, and she was speaking at. So that would cover that thing, those free tickets that can't be resold. That would have been
amazing.
Interesting. Yeah. And it's if we can get Taylor Swift into Waitress, into Waitress, that'd be great.
Boy, when I graduated NYU, it was still in Washington Square Park. That's how old I am.
When I graduated NYU, it was NY College. It wasn't even New York University. So, Peter,
yeah,
did you get in the Felicia Mobile, or did you take a big aeroplane to get out to Flint, Michigan?
I had to go to Charlotte, North Carolina. I had to run to get my connecting flight because it arrived at 7:29 and my next plane to Flint, Michigan was at 7:59.
Wow, you made that connection?
I'm telling you, it was just amazing beyond belief.
It's not amazing. It was fantastic.
Good for you, because that's what I was going to see. Yeah, there I was arriving at C-19, and I had to get to E-11. You know, and I'm telling you, I have never walked so fast. I was looking for one of those cute little golf carts to take me there, and I found one, and the guy said, "We're paramedics. We can't take you." You know, so, and I'm running, and I did make the plane. Of course, coming back when I had a 2-hour and 20-minute layover, I arrived in Chicago at B1 and my flight was at B2, you know, 2.5 hours later. So life isn't hard enough. Anyway, yes, I went to Flint, Michigan because they were doing the Fantastics in a gay version. So I was very interested in seeing that. And, you know, Flint has certainly had a lot of publicity in the last few years for this, that, and the other thing.
I was just going to say, I hope you didn't drink the water.
Well, yeah, I know everybody says that. And there's no question when you check into the hotel that they say, would you like bottled water, sir? So so the town really, as I see it, is really split into two sections. One section, yes, there are a lot of closed stores and what have you, though there's an enormous and wonderful bookstore of used bookstore there that I went to and had a wonderful time at and bought some things. So there's that part of town that looks rather depressed. And yet the University of Michigan at Flint is on the other side of the town and everything's beautifully manicured and beautiful buildings and wonderfully kept up. And in that part of town is the Flint Repertory Theater. And there indeed, the artistic director, a gentleman named, I pronounce it Luberis, Michael Luberis, there, and he's from that part of the world. He's not quite from Flint. He's from a small town, a town even smaller than Flint. And he's been there for a few years now, and he had the idea of doing the Gay Fantastics. In fact, he had it years ago. He did it in scene study class when he was teaching somewhere, and he often thought about doing this. So he got in touch with Tom Jones, and Tom Jones not only gave his blessing, but also said, yes, well, I'll have to write some new lyrics. I mean, after all, you do have I Want Much More Than Keeping House, you know, and you don't think of initially when you hear that lyric, you would think that we're talking about a woman. So it became I Want Much More Than This Small Town. Much more. And my hair unfastens till it billows to the floor. So here it became to let my hair keep growing till it billows to the floor. So it was really something to see the audience, which it was very close to a full house. I would say the theater has about 200 seats in it. And I was very curious as how the audience was going to respond to it. And I think this is a tribute to Michael that indeed his audience will go in the direction that he wants to go. They will very easily take the journey with him, which they definitely did. I mean, they were with it from the first moment it started. It was so wonderful. I mean, even the throwing of confetti from the mute got a hand, you know, so they really were behind it. And there was not a single problem in terms of guys kissing. And we had not only the Matt and Lewis, as opposed to Louisa, kissing more than once, but also El Gallo did some kissing as well. And as a result, you know, the audience was not freaked out. None of that stuff. They really were behind it. They applauded vigorously. They had a wonderful time. And I have to say it was very well performed too. And what was really nice was the fact that of the eight actors, four came from Flint or thereabouts, and the other four were imported from here, there, and everywhere. It was very nice. The guy who played El Gallo has actually been on Broadway a couple of times. So it was a nice mixture, and that's really wonderful when that happens in regional theater, because so many regional theaters started out wanting to employ local actors, and it didn't take long before they started bringing in people from out of town. And I've always felt bad that people weren't getting the opportunities in their very neighborhood. So anyway, that's how it worked out. And I have to say that you couldn't tell the out-of-town actors from the local ones. And I mean that in the best sense of the word. I don't mean that the out-of-town actors were inferior, and that's why the local actors seem the same. No, what I mean is the local actors, if I were asked, you know, okay, four of them came from out of town and four didn't, which are the ones? I wouldn't have guessed because I thought they were all excellent. Excellent. Now, a very smart thing was the fact that not only were the boys the lovers, but instead of fathers, you had mothers. And I think this was a good decision because, mothers tend to be more indulgent of gay sons than fathers are. That's a generalization, I'll grant you. But I certainly in my experience, I have certainly found that fathers have a tougher time accepting gay sons than mothers do. So I thought that was really quite good. And the two women who played the parts, Diane Hill and Catherine Schaffner, were really quite terrific. And they had a wonderful chemistry between them. For those who don't know the Fantastics, and I imagine everybody does, this is about parents, let's put it that way, who really would like to see their kids get together. And they know that if they say, why don't you get involved with the kid next door, the kids would immediately rebel. So they purposely pretend to have a feud so that the kids will rebel and certainly get together. You know, it certainly was interesting to me to think about this show in the context of Into the Woods, because there is a similarity, because at the end of the first act is an ostensibly happy ending. Mm. And then things get dour, you know, and, you know, the audience had a wonderful time during the first act laughing and identifying with the idea of rebelling against your parents. They remember when they were doing that, all that kind of stuff. And so they were having a wonderful time. And then things get very serious in the second act when you think of it. I mean, after all, after the people get what they want, just like Into the Woods, and again, Lord knows that the Fantastics was 27 years before Into the Woods, but nevertheless, it was so interesting to me that I never thought of that before, but it really occurred to me this time that there is that same type of thing. So things get very serious in the second act of the Fantastics, where the boy heads out and the world turns out to be far more threatening and than he expected it to be. And even though he'd been warned, in certainly I can see it, El Gallo warns him that beyond that road lies despair. So, and meanwhile, the girl, well, in this case, of course, Lewis, feels, you know, I don't want to be with this guy anymore. And then, of course, she changes her mind when he's gone. You know, he changes his mind when he's gone. So so it does get serious, you know, and of course, there is a happy ending. And what's really wonderful, of course, is the Jones and Schmidt score, which is certainly one of the greatest in off-Broadway history, even down to the dance music. I just love the dance music in this show. And it was very, very well sung, beautifully sung by everybody. Everybody did a fine job with that, and it was just a pleasure to hear. So that's good. Oh, other changes in the lyric, and go to town in a golden gown, go to town with a golden crown. That's very good, I think. And as opposed to please don't let me be normal, which that would be fine, you know, but it was better to have please let me be somebody special. I thought that was a very smart change, too. So really, all things considered, there was no problem whatsoever with the way it played. Very, very nicely done on a very bare stage. White. Everything was white. A white wall, a little cutout out there for when the old actor came in with his sidekick. And there you had this wonderful, wonderful, wonderful lighting that was so evocative. And I really have to say, whoever Chelsea McPhillamy is, she or he is going to have a career because, oh, glorious, glorious tints. And there was a rainbow effect, as you might expect. And I thought that was really, really something. So I was delighted that I went, and I really felt that this should have a future. And my hat is off to Michael Liberis for making it happen. And I hope we see plenty more productions of the Fantastics with the gay element. And I hope that they could possibly be as good as this one was.
Well, I have to ask you, obviously the gay changes that is the hook here, but I'm so curious as any production of Fantastics now, but especially this one, two questions. What did they do about the abduction? Which version of the song did they use? And then also, you mentioned the old actor and his sidekick. Do they still call him an Indian?
No, Indian didn't come up at all. In fact, it was, I should have mentioned this, it was played as a drag queen. Jason Briggs is the gentleman who did it, and he did a fabulous job. And the audience loved this, and I use this term specifically, fabulous type of interpretation. So that was really quite good, too. No, there was nothing about that whatsoever. Not at all. But
the abduction?
The abduction, the very smart thing. It was one of those things where you really say to yourself, why didn't they think of this years ago? Mm. Because, of course, the problem was the word rape didn't have the same ominous. I mean, God knows rape has always been terrible. Don't misunderstand me. But there's been much more awareness of rape since the Fantastics opened. And even in the Superman musical in 1966, there's a lyric about rape, and you know, it not that it's funny per se, but I mean, we've certainly had too much more we've had too many more incidents of rape that there's nothing funny about it anymore. And it was so simple, they used the word raid as opposed to rape. Isn't that great? I mean, why didn't people think that a million years ago? I mean, that solves the problem.
Well, Tom Jones has been coming up with various solutions over the years. They had one. First, they rewrote the lyrics for the original song, and mm-hmm. they put that into the off-Broadway show. Then he wrote a completely different song called Abduction.
Right.
For the movie, I know I'm telling you things you know already.
Yeah, no, but it's but, good yeah. that listeners are hearing it.
And so I really admire him that he's still working at it.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, it's so amazing to think that he would still be interested in doing something, because, of course, he could certainly rest in his laurels. And I mean, it's amazing. I took out my cast album of the Fantastics, the CD, and I was surprised that I didn't remember that I actually had in there a CD that somebody had given me of the Mexican production. You know, I mean, so God knows this has been done all over the world. And one of my great theatrical tragedies was when I was in Israel in 1991. I missed it by a week. It was going to open the week after I was there. And I was so sad. I mean, okay, seeing Let Us in Love and View from the Bridge in Hebrew was fine, but I would have rather seen the Fantastics than either one of them. So it's the worldwide phenomenon that this became. And God bless Laurie Noto, who believed in this from day one. I mean, he was able to go to Barnard University and a college, I guess, and see this just as a one act and saying, you can expand this. It's going to be better if you expand it. I will do it. I will do it. And you have all the artistic decisions. The only time I will come in with it to give any advice is when you say to me, we don't know what to do. But otherwise, you are totally in control. And that's why they went with him. I mean, he had only produced one show before called The Failures, which had lasted one night. Truth in advertising, huh? But I mean, he just stuck with it and he made it happen. And he really revolutionized so many ideas, because he closed the show for a week and took it to the Hamptons so that people could see it there. And I think he let everybody in free. And as a result, the Tony people in the Hamptons was really word of mouth said, oh, you've got to see the Fantastics. And that's really one of the reasons that it was able to stay around. And of course, the idea of selling it to TV, it was done in 1964 on the Hallmark Hall of Fame, while it was obviously still running. off Broadway. And, you know, a lot of people said, are you crazy? You're giving it away, you know, and Judd Davison played the boy and Susan Watson, the girl, and Burt Lahr and Stanley Holloway were the fathers. And there it was on TV. And all it did was stoke the interest in the show. And of course it was a low budget production, I'll grant you. And there's a documentary called Try to Remember, fittingly enough. And the thing is that on that documentary, somebody's who was in the show said, there were some nights we were playing to 20 and 30 people, but the expenses were really kept down. And my buddy Ken Cantor, who played El Gallo for a while in the off-Broadway production, said Laurie used to go around, you know, like, and shut off lights to in offices to make sure that the electric bills were down. But that's a producer who knew where the expenses were, and he really kept it down so we could keep it running, which he did for 42 years. So until he really got too sick and, you know, said, I just, you know, have to abdicate. So that was that. But anyway, back to Flint, a wonderful idea. And I hope that many theaters take up the mantle and say, yes, let's do it this way. Because an audience that isn't used to this certainly felt very comfortable at this Gay Fantastics.
Peter, do you think that MTI, who licenses this, is going to include these changes into the licensing now, so it makes it easier for companies to license this and do it without having to, you know, search far and wide for these changes?
I do know that they've talked to MTI, so I do know that there is some sort of negotiating going on, whether it's going to be a complete, you can do the Gay Fantastics, or here are some changes that are permissible. I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that there has been discussion with MTI, which does license the property.
All right.
Well, two quick things. The that TV production you mentioned is for many years was available only in a really grainy black and white kinescope version on video. But not too long ago, I think I might have mentioned this, it was somebody, and I think it's somebody we know, but we can't go into that anymore, had it in color. And it's currently on YouTube if you want to look for it. And I think it's really worth it. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful production. It's only an hour long, but they did a brilliant job of editing it. So really check it out. Susan Watson and John Davidson are just about perfect as the lovers. And they have no less than Stanley Holloway and Burt Lahr as the fathers. Yeah. And the weaker link is, I would say, Ricardo Montalban as El Gallo, but only because he doesn't sing that well. Every other way, he's perfect the part. So really check that out. And then the other thing I think we mentioned recently is that there is going to be, and it may already have happened as far as the doing of it, a complete audio recording of the show with all of the score and the dialogue, including the dance music that Peter mentioned, by J Records. So you can look forward to that at some point.
All right. So that is The Fantastics at Flint Repertory Theater. It's playing through June 19th, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Michael, you got out to Lambertville, New Jersey to see a production of Godspell at the Music Mountain Theater. So tell us about this.
Yes, this is the second show I've seen at the Music Mountain Theater, which is as James said, in Lambertville, New Jersey, which is kind of far out and actually just a stone's throw from Bucks County. You drive about 5 minutes and then you come to that bridge that goes over the beautiful Delaware River. And then you're right in the heart of Bucks County. I had seen American Idiot there and I went to see Godspell. Primarily the reason I went was because one of the actors was Matthew Drinkwater, who's going to be one of the Antipholi in my upcoming Boys from Syracuse that James was kind enough to mention before. And so I'm glad I went because it was a really excellent production overall, directed and choreographed by Louis Palena. The only slight disappointment for me was that although it doesn't actually say this, it sounded to me like they used the arrangements that we heard in the Broadway revival that was done at Circle in the Square by Michael Holland, I believe. And although I don't dislike those arrangements, I do prefer the originals. I guess it's just because I've had them ingrained in my brain, you know, since 1970 or whenever that year, that exact year that was that the show opened and the album came out. So that was a little disappointing. But other than that, the company was really very strong, and the choral singing in particular was quite wonderful. And Matthew did a beautiful job with All Good Gifts, which I sang in high school at a, I remember, we didn't do gospel in high school, but I sang it at a mass because I went to a boys Catholic high school, and I sang All Good Gifts, and I've always loved that song. And he just sang it beautifully. Really a lot of wonderful business in that you have so much freedom with Godspell, and the staging, they did things that I've never seen before. They did one whole scene where the entire cast was playing with strings that were strung all over the set. And that was really fun. It must have required quite a lot of rehearsal. I'm noticing here there were actually two people directed as credited as director and choreographer, Louis Pelena and Jordan Brennan. So I guess it took two people to do this. And they did a really wonderful job. Lots of topical humor, you know, which is easy to throw into Godspell. There was even a reference to the Amber Heard Johnny Depp situation, wow, which they had to update because the verdict had come in like the day before, you know.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's I think they have sometimes maybe had equity artists working with them on a waiver or whatever. But this is a completely non-equity company, but very, very high level community theater, I guess that's the word for it. Mm-hmm. And I would check it out if you ever happen to be in the area, if you happen to be in Bucks County. It's really very close and well worth this brief drive to the Music Mountain Theater in Lambertville.
Okay, and that production is playing through June the 12th, which is next Sunday, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Peter, you got over to the Roundabout Theater Company's Laura Pell's Theater to see what the end will be. So tell us, what will the end be?
Well, this play sort of changes ideas in midstream. Montserrat wrote it, and it started out with an intoxicatingly interesting idea, because it deals with a grandfather, father, and son. So we have three generations, and all three men are gay. Now, the grandfather lived in an era where you got married if you were gay, because you wanted to obfuscate that and you didn't want anybody to know. But he was always in love with somebody, and but he didn't deal with it. But then his wife died, and immediately he hooked up with the guy that he always loved, because times had changed. So one of my favorite actors certainly was very, very strong in this situation, because I'm always looking forward to seeing Keith Randolph Smith in anything. All right. So the second, his son, had a very different experience. Yes, he got married too, but he dumped his wife so that he could be with his lover. And that, by the way, Randy Harrison, who you may recall from Queer as Folk, played the lover. So, and he was quite excellent. So, and then you have the son of, or the grandson, depending on how you look at it. And he certainly has issues with his boyfriend too. And there's a bit of problem, because indeed the son's boyfriend is very, very effeminate and bold about it. And that sort of turns off the father and the grandfather. So while they're gay, they're sort of intolerant towards this very, very, you should pardon the expression, queenie type of individual. Okay, that's what it seems to be about. And then suddenly it becomes about the grandfather being very, very ill and wanting to commit suicide, and the other two not wanting them him to do it. you know, it was just amazing to see that after they established this whole thing about the conflict, about the boyfriend and all that, it was somewhat, not totally, don't misunderstand me, it was somewhat forgotten because the situation turned on whether or not the guy has the right to do it. So it became one of those plays about, do you have the right to take your own life when you're suffering so much and you want to be relieved of the suffering? So it was very strange. It was almost like two different plays. But that said, very, very well done. Margot Bordelon directed very, very nicely, a terrifically ornate set by Reed Thompson, letting us know that this is a Black family, but certainly a well-to-do Black family. And it's always wonderful when you see that. So rather than the cliche of the Blacks who are struggling, of course, both situations are apt and true. But nevertheless, it's always nice to be reminded that there are many, many, many wildly successful Blacks. And these people certainly had money, but they also had problems. So I wish it hadn't changed in midstream. I would have liked to have seen a play either continue on this, what it started to do, or deal with it from the very beginning, the need to commit suicide when you really feel you can't take it anymore. So what the end will be had an ending in the middle of one play and then had an ending again of a second play. So there you have it.
Mm-hmm. Written by Mansarah.
Right.
Which I was disappointed that his bio ends with, he lives in Hollywood with his fiancée and their dog. I don't have a problem with the fiancée or the dog. I just feel like, are they really writing for Broadway if they're living in Hollywood? MFA in playwriting from Yale School of Drama.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it's going where the money is, you know. I mean, yeah. Who can blame?
No, sure. Absolutely. So what the end will be ending July 10th at the Laura Pels. Right now, scheduled through July 10th, but we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Michael, you got over to Theater Row to see Mr. Parker. Is this Peter Parker of Spider-Man? Who is this Mr. Parker?
No, it's a very different type of character. this is a new play by Michael McKeever, who had written a play called Daniel's Husband, which I liked very much.
Oh, so did I. Sure, so did I. Mm.
And directed by Joe Brancato.
Very good director.
And starring one of the three actors in it is Derek Smith, who, first of all, I've admired for many years as an actor, and he now lives in my building because I moved into his building. So he's my neighbor. So it was great to see him, and I only had to walk across the street to Theater Row. Homey in that way. And it's about a late middle-aged gay man who has lost his partner. His partner has died. We eventually are told that it was in a car accident, but we're not given really more information about that, at least not at the beginning. And this fellow is really not doing well in terms of his emotional state because of the death and just growing older and his own mortality, et cetera, et cetera. But then he hooks up with a much younger fellow who is a bartender and an Uber driver named Justin. And that role is played by Davy, or maybe it's Davi, D-A-V-I, Santos. Derek's character is named Terry Parker, hence the Mr. Parker. It's really about whether this is just going to be a hookup or if it's going to be something a lot more serious. And I enjoyed a lot of it. I did think it was really kind of talky and there was a lot of on the nose dialogue maybe that could have been worked a little bit more. I don't think it's as good a play as Daniel's Husband. But I did want to see it because I do enjoy the writer's work. To me, there was, a really excellent set at I guess it's called Theater One now, because the theaters at Theater Row now just have numbers. Yeah. They don't have names. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is the theater where Mel Miller was doing musicals Tonight for all those years. Mm-hmm. But the scenic design for this production is by David Goldstein. And he really did a great job of putting a very believable apartment on stage at that not large stage. So if you see this, I think you'll really be impressed with that. I've never seen so elaborate a set, in any of those theaters. Although sometimes the Mint, they did a few shows there that they did some really nice sets. But anyway, this one is stellar work. My main, if any of you go see it, tell me if you have the same reaction. There was the strangest thing that happened, because towards the end of the play, we're given quite a shocking piece of information. And it seemed to me that it should have been the kind of thing that caused the audience to gasp and changed our entire perception of everything that we had already seen happen. But it was delivered in such an offhand, nonchalant way that I think a lot of people didn't even get it. And I wish I could ask the director and the actor, was that really a conscious choice? You would think it must have been that either the actor or the director said, well, we don't want to make this seem like melodrama. So we're just going to really, really underplay it. But I thought it was a tremendous mistake. And I thought that that the whole ending of the play seemed anticlimactic because of it, whereas if they had just played that one moment and if they had taken it and played it up a lot more, I think that really would have improved the whole production. So that is a question I'm going to ask them if I ever, if I get my courage up after the play is over, if I see Derek in the elevator, I'll ask him that question. And as I say, if any of our listeners go to see the play, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Or if any of you have seen it already, please feel free to email us or whatever.
All right. So Mr. Parker at Theater Row is playing through June 25th, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Michael is trying to get up his courage to talk to him, but Peter got over to the Irondale Ensemble Project to see Mother Courage and her children. So Peter, tell us about this production.
Well, this closes today, and it's certainly going to be a lame duck review. But I like the Irondale very much. They're in a church in Brooklyn, not so hard to get to. A few subway lines run there, and it's not much of a walk from the subway. So if there's something you want to see there, don't get discouraged by the trip, is what I'm saying. So Mother Courage and Her Children is one of my all-time favorite plays because it deals with a woman who has a canteen that she a little cart that she drags around and she sells to people, soldiers specifically, during a war. And she loves when there's a war because then there are soldiers around who need what she has to sell. However, she also has three children, and those three children will be impacted by the war. One of them enlists. When her back is turned, he wants to get away and see the world and all that kind of stuff and fight and all that. And that's that for him. The second one actually becomes a bit of a bureaucrat with the war. And he does essentially profit from the war just as she's been profiting. And the third one is a daughter who unfortunately gets scarred from the war, from a soldier. And the girl has desperately hoped that she would find a husband. And the fact that she's a mute is a problem for her. She knows that that's a liability. And once she has the scar on her forehead, that really does her in. She really feels like there's no hope for her whatsoever. So it's about the fact that war is economically good for people. And but, of course, there are so many liabilities attached to that. And Bertolt Brecht goes back and forth. It's wonderful to see at one scene you're saying, well, I understand why the woman is happy about the war, and I understand why she's unhappy. It goes back and forth and back and forth. And there's one very important scene when you really see that she loves her children so much. So that's important too, because you know the dichotomy between loving the war and loving your children. So I think it's a very special play. Now, one of the things I remember when Paper Mill did Ragtime, I complained bitterly that there was no car, because you know, the car is such an important symbol in the show. Well, so is the wagon, I think, and they didn't have one. So I sort of missed that in this production. Jim Neeson adapted the play and directed it as well. And I would have liked to have seen a car. Instead, they just had two ropes hanging from a balcony, and she was pulling that. But there's something about the wagon that's really important, because you see her with her three children, and all of them are helping pulling the wagon. And little by little, of course, she has to wind up pulling it herself when she's left without any of her children. So that's a very strong thing. So I'm sorry that didn't happen. However, you did have a wonderful performance by Vicki Gilmore as Mother Courage, a really, really terrific performance. Nolan Kennedy is the oldest child. Terry Grice as a character known as Swiss Cheese. I think that has to do with his complexion. And the daughter, Catherine, by Jacqueline Jonkis, was quite effective as well. It was only done with about five or six people. Why am I not being more specific? Because it was one of those things where you get the little little maze type of thing as a playbill, and you have to click on and use your phone to find out who's who. Well, the problem was that by the time I did that, it was no longer working. So, and I even had a techie, not as skilled as James Marino, I'll grant you, but a techie, you know, tried to do it, and he couldn't figure it out either. So, so I wish I could be more specific, but anyway, it's closing today. But the point of my bringing this up is the Nightingale does solid work, and it was very well performed. I'm just sorry they didn't have a wagon.
All right. So that is Mother Courage and Her Children at Irondale Ensemble Project. As Peter mentioned, it is closing today, June 5th. But we'll have a link to that in the show notes so that you can check out Irondale's other projects and what's coming up. Michael, you got back to the Broadway production of Company. So what is this, your second or third viewing of this?
Only the second.
And how did you feel about it?
I was really, really happy to see it again. As I said when I reviewed it the first time, my feelings haven't changed. I think it's incredibly entertaining, despite the fact that it doesn't really work with the new concept. And I'm still debating with myself whether it's more of a problem that the gender of the main character was changed, or that the action was updated to the present day. I really think it's more the second thing, but a combination of both. Regardless, it's just so well done, and the audience loves this production so much. I'm sorry it's not doing better, apparently, than it is, because despite my major reservations with the whole concept, it is so entertaining. And, you know, I mean, it's the book is still the book, largely by George Firth. Those scenes are so well written, and the humor is hilarious, and played to the hilt by this amazing company. It was so great to see Matt Doyle do Getting Married Today again, especially the first time I had seen it was before he got his Tony nomination, and now he's got it, and the audience, the the ovation after that number was spectacular because not only is he and the rest of the company so great in it, but the staging is beyond brilliant. Really, just really excellent. So I was very happy to see it again. I still really like Katrina Lenk a lot and can't really understand a lot of the criticism of her performance that I've heard. I still always enjoy and love the privilege of seeing and hearing Patti LuPone on stage, even though in this case, I think she's very miscast. I have, it's a show that I'm sorry, grateful about, I guess really, because even while I'm saying, my brain is saying, oh, that doesn't work, that doesn't make any sense, blah, 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 blah. And I don't, there's some of the new lyrics that Mr. Sondheim wrote. I think some of them are great and some of them are really quite lame, to be perfectly honest. But even while I'm noticing all the flaws, I just really loved it and loved going back. I was very happy that I was invited back. And I brought my friend Kevin McInerney because I know he always says it's his favorite show.
That's right. You know, that's right. Yeah. He's seen it like 35 productions.
Yeah.
Something
yeah, with
like
every
that.
Possible yeah. Bobby you could ever
right.
meet.
Yeah. 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 I went back too, by the way, and I thought it was terrific. And, you know, the talk about Bobby being a cipher and what have you. I was very entertained by Katrina Lenk's reactions, her plastic smiles when she had to smile at things that she didn't agree with and all that. It's a very, very, very fine performance. And I really was glad to see it again just for that. I can't think of a performance where facial expressions are so important, given the fact that you do have to react to your friends and what they're telling you, whether it being, yeah, we're getting a divorce and yeah, we got our divorce, but we're still living together. And we're happy now that we're divorced, that we don't have the pressure of being married. You know, all those things, you know, a lot of surprising things that happen in company. And of course, when there is the concept of not getting married, you know, at the last minute, changing your mind, her having to deal with all that and be loyal to both friends. And so really a terrific performance by her. Michael, I can't say I agree with you on Patti LuPone being miscast. I think she's fine. And but all in all, it's a wonderful production. It is selling 75% of its seats, and we'd like to see that go higher. And I'd like to see this because, after all, this is a sophisticated musical, and I don't want Broadway to lose sophistication that it was so famous for having in the golden age. I'd like to see that returned. And the fact that the audience does meet its expectations is very, very significant. They really did love it the time I went.
And it's very necessary as an antidote to things like Six.
Oh, we are.
No, I mean, seriously.
I know what you mean.
Come on, look at those two shows. No,
I understand. Yeah. I understand.
So, Michael, what day of the week did you go see Company?
I saw it on Tuesday, the 31st.
I saw it on Wednesday. So
Wednesday afternoon or evening?
I was at night. It was the week before, by the way, 25th, whatever it was.
Oh, okay.
So it's nice that we were at different performances.
And the night I went, there was only one substitution. Tally Sessions was in for Greg Hildreth.
That happened last night, too. I had a friend who was there.
So Claiborne Elder almost missed a performance.
Oh, no. What happened?
On Wednesday. He had a little emergency on Wednesday, and at 1:53, he was in a cab across town trying to make a 2 o'clock matinee.
Wow.
And all of New York pulled together to get him to the church on time.
No kidding.
So I have a link to that little story from Claiborne Elder in the show notes if you want to read that story. When I read it, my heart was pounding. I was like, did he make it? Did he not make it? But we'll put that in the show notes, and you can check it out if you're interested. But Claiborne is just so, so funny. And all of the
He's good at that kind of publicity, too.
He is
very good at that kind of publicity.
He's very, very good at social media. He is. He's a great follow. Michael, you got over to City Center for our last talk this morning, where Jacques d'Amboise had a memorial for Jacques. So tell us about this.
Yeah, I only found out about this literally an hour beforehand. And I'm so glad that I did, because he really was a towering figure in the dance world. Born 1934, died 2021. I guess people who are not that familiar with dance per se are most likely to know him from the film versions of Carousel and also Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, because he's featured in both. In Carousel, he is the carnival boy in the yeah. ballet that happens at the end of Louise's ballet. And he really was a great artist, and had even a greater career as a teacher. He is taught generations of young dancers, and there was even a film documentary about him some years ago called "He Makes Me Feel Like Dancing," which I didn't get a chance to look it up. I think it might have either won an Oscar or at least been up for one. But either way, you can check that out. I'm sure it's probably easy to get a hold of that. But this was a great. This was, as I said to Kevin McInerney, who was the one who told me about this an hour beforehand, and God love him for it. This was probably the most beautifully produced one of these events that I've ever seen. I guess it was supposed to happen, during, they were going to try to do it during COVID, because as I said, Jacques died in 2021, but then I think that was when Omicron happened. So they delayed it until now. And it was just incredible. If anything, it was pretty long. It was, I think, almost 2.5 hours. But the talent on display from all of these dance companies, and then all of Jacques' children spoke, including his son Christopher and Charlotte d'Amboise. And Charlotte and Brenda Braxton did a number from Chicago. They did the Hot Honey Rag, also nowadays, but they brought on the hook here was that for the Hot Honey Rag, they brought on like 50 people.
Wow.
It's 50 young people to back them up, and that was incredible. But there were remarks and appearances and speeches by Bill Irwin, Cheetah Rivera. Brian Stokes Mitchell showed up to sing The Impossible Dream, which he said was Jacques' favorite song.
Oh,
yeah. Cool. Yeah. And it just really, the amount of it looks so professional. I can't imagine that they could have had much rehearsal time for something like this. But the lighting, for example, was absolutely phenomenal. And it's not easy to light dance numbers involving huge numbers of people on a big stage like that. So my hat is off to them for putting such a beautiful tribute together. He really was extraordinary. Look him up if you don't know about him. Look up excerpts of him dancing in movies and live performances. But also, he was such a colorful figure. He had the thickest New York accent you've ever heard in your life. He talked like this. This is how I talk, and now I'm going to get up and I'm going to do some ballet.
No kidding.
Oh, God. I'm not exaggerating. Really. If you think I am, look him up.
Fine. I certainly shall. Not because I doubt you, because it's going to be fun to hear that.
And actually, my theory is that that's why he, that may be part of the reason why he didn't become a film star. Charlotte said that he was offered a 7-year contract from MGM, but he turned it down to go back and work with George Balanchine.
Wow.
Just an incredible artist who, as I say, touched generations through his work as a teacher.
So he makes me feel like dancing.
Was, yes.
It won an Academy Award and a Primetime Emmy Award. It's one of the few films that have won both.
Oh,
So, yeah. And I'll have a link to that in the show notes of all the different things from Jacques' career, including a bunch of YouTube stuff where you hear him talk with his New York accent.
Oh, very quick, funny story. Charlotte told she was performing at I forget what event the event was, and Jacques was in the audience, and it may have been a tribute to him. But anyway, she sang What I Did for Love, and she was so emotional that she didn't do that great a job with it, by her own admission. So, but afterwards, she went over to her father and embraced him. And while the audience was cheering, he hugged her, and he whispered in her ears, "Exit stage right."
Well, with that, let's wrap it up for the morning. Before we get on to the musical moment and trivia, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to Apple Podcasts for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us on Apple Podcasts. There's many ways to listen to us. Spotify, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Google Play, anywhere that you can listen to find a podcast, you'll find Broadway Radio's offerings. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me can be found in the show notes at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So, Peter, do we have an answer for last week's trivia?
Remember in high school math when you had to solve those analogy problems that said 3 is to 6 as 6 is to, and the answer was 12? Okay, here's a musical theater one. Charles Strauss is to Frank Wildhorn as Henry Mancini is to whom? Bob Merrill. And here's why. Charles Strauss wrote the film score music to Bonnie and Clyde, and Frank Wildhorn wrote the music for the Broadway musical Bonnie and Clyde. Henry Mancini wrote the film score to Breakfast at Tiffany's, and Bob Merrill wrote the music, and for that matter, the lyrics too, to the Broadway musical Breakfast at Tiffany's, to his regret, but that's another story. Once again, for the third week in a row, Juliet Green got it.
There
followed
she
by
is.
Yeah, I'm telling you, with Jack Leshner, Josh Israel, Mike Iwanis, Brigadude, J. Aubrey Jones, Deb Popple, and Paul Witte. And what about Tony Janicki? Dear listeners, do fasten your seatbelts, for it's going to be a bumpy explanation. Tony guessed Raymond Scott. And who? And here's how he reached that answer. He says that Charles Strauss composed full scores for 13 Broadway musicals, and Frank Wildhorn composed full scores for 6 Broadway musicals. Henry Mancini, a film composer, wrote the music for 13 songs in his only Broadway musical, Victor Victoria. Raymond Scott, another film composer, wrote the musical for 6 songs in his only Broadway musical, Lute Song. When I said no, and by the way, according to IBDB, Lute Song had 7 songs. He then stated that Charles Strauss composed full scores for 14 musicals. You said 13 before, Tony. While Frank Wildhorn is composed for 6. And Tony said that Strauss's productivity over Wildhorn's is roughly 2.3 to 1. 2.3. I think Tony has been drinking too much 3.2 beer. I mean, I've never given a brain teaser that involves fractions. But Tony, you've inspired me to come up with the one in the future that involves fractions. We're almost done. Then he went on to say that Henry Mancini composed the songs for 2 major film musicals, Darling Lily and Victor Victoria, the latter becoming a Broadway musicals. And he wrote the songs for High Time and 10, and the underscore for the Breakfast at Tiffany's film, which also became a Broadway musical. So we had the concept that Breakfast at Tiffany's became a musical on Broadway, but he didn't put two and two, or even 2.3 and 2.3 together. So to figure out that Bob Merrill was involved. Tony, I cannot wait to see your explanation why the world is actually flat. I look forward to that. Anyway, this week's question. The Theater World books that used to be published annually would list the song titles for every musical of the season. In one edition, it claimed that a certain song was called Goodbye, Failure, Goodbye, according to the cast album, the studio cast album, and the playbill. That's not the song's official title. What is, and in what show can you find the song?
Okay, if you have an answer for that, and you think you can beat Juliet Green, You better get on it quickly and email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com. So, Michael, what do we have in this week's musical moment?
Our music this week are two brief audio excerpts from the Music Mountain Theater production of Godspell.
Really? They were actual production. Wow.
Yeah. And the opener is a little bit of Prepare Ye, and which is appropriate, I think. Mm-hmm. And the closer is Matthew Drinkwater's beautiful rendition of All Good Gifts. So please enjoy these two excerpts from Stephen Schwartz's gorgeous, classic, immortal score for Godspell.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've already got the answer from Juliet Green, so anybody else, just give it up.
Is she a latecomer? It seems to me that her name has only popped up recently, but she's
a long, long time listener and Patreon supporter of us. She joins us on Sunday mornings to listen live.
Oh, but it only seems like recently that she's been the first person to really get the answer. So I'm very impressed, I have to say.
So am I.
All right. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Juliet says she's finally figuring out Peter's mind.
Okay. That must be it. Well, good for you.
Someday I hope to find out what it is. Yeah. Anyway.
Thank you for